Today we have the unique opportunity of discussing the history of AIPAC and its powerful influence on U.S. policy with one of the most important investigators of its activities. Grant F. Smith is the Director of Research at the Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy, a Washington-based nonprofit organization that studies U.S. Middle East policy formulation. Grant Smith has written 5 books: Neocon Middle East Policy, The Clean Break Damage Assessment, Deadly Dogma, How Neoconservatives Broke the Law to Deceive America, Visa Denied, How Anti-Arab Visa Policies Destroy U.S. Exports, Jobs, and Higher Education, Foreign Agents, The American-Israel Public Affairs Committee from the 1963 Fulbright hearings to the 2005 espionage scandal, and his most recent book, America's Defense Line, the Justice Department's Battle to Register the Israel Lobby as Agents of a Foreign Government. He joins us now from his home in Washington. Good morning, Mr. Grant F. Smith.
Good morning, sir. Thanks for having me on this important program this morning.
Yes, it's our pleasure, sir. Thank you. There is much ground to cover, but as usual, I'm afraid not much time to discuss it. May I call you Grant?
Absolutely.
In referring again to the Mearsheimer and Walt book, and in their subsequent public discussions, both Mearsheimer and Walt have consistently tried to make the case that AIPAC was not single-handedly responsible for steering American foreign policy in a pro-Israel direction. They have claimed that AIPAC's effect was felt only when the interests it was promoting happened to coincide with other interests promoted by other lobbies, such as the oil lobby, or when domestic politics, whatever that means, drove the foreign policy agenda. Is it fair to say that the historical record you have uncovered during your research tells a compellingly different story?
Yes, it is. And I think the approach of my research, which is getting documentary primary research and evidence about the factors driving the system, refutes a lot of this circumstantial theorizing. In systems dynamics, there's usually one driver that substantially impacts other drivers in the system. And when we look at history and what was going on behind the scenes, which is so important, we find that the lobby in its various iterations, and this is a regenerative, from a corporate standpoint, a regenerative entity, has consistently played a leadership role. The problem for Americans has always been that in this particular policy arena, we typically don't actually see information relevant to decisions actually in play until, on average, about 4 decades after the moment to effect change has passed, if ever.
Usually until it's too late to make a difference.
Correct.
Perhaps we should note here that AIPAC, the name AIPAC, is really a 1959 reincarnation of 3 precursors. The American Zionist Council, the Kennan Committee after its founder Isaiah Cy Kennan, and the American Zionist Committee for Public Affairs.
Right.
Let's start with the Fulbright hearings, which you covered in your book, Foreign Agents. Could you set the stage for us, Grant?
Sure. Back in 1962, Senator J.W. Fulbright, who was leading the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, was becoming increasingly concerned about the seemingly grassroots pressures being directed at Congress to win various concessions, aid, and win over Congress for some programs that were essentially not in America's interests. Although his investigators were looking at all sorts of countries, including Dominican Republic and lobbyists for the Philippines, he found that approximately, in today's dollars, $35 million had been what we would call money laundering today, moved into the American political and public relations efforts to win more aid, arms, and influence for Israel. He had a series of hearings, 2 of which focused entirely upon Israel's foreign agents active in the United States in May and August of 1963, which put into the documentary record evidence of criminal wrongdoing in money laundering, in propagandizing, in trying to win what grassroots American support could not win for itself without this foreign agent factor. So in a nutshell, that's the public record. What we had declassified and have been distributing since about June 10 of this year, is what actually happened to the AIPAC precursor, because the record in the press and in mainstream media effectively ends in 1963 when everyone says, well, the AZC went away, and, oh, by the way, AIPAC has been active since then in doing essentially what this precursor organization was active in. What we uncovered was how the Department of Justice was attempting to register AIPAC's precursor as a foreign agent and shed more light on its activities.
So I guess here we have Senator Fulbright questioning an array of AIPAC's elite to try and shed light on AIPAC's activities.
Right. He was going after the financing arm of AIPAC, which at this time was the quasi-governmental Jewish agency in Jerusalem. This was the government in waiting. If you think about Ahmed Chalabi and his cohorts as a government in waiting for Iraq, the Jewish agency was essentially playing the same role. It was a registered foreign agent in New York since 1938, trying to practically implement the Herzl vision for a new state in Palestine, trying to get together the political influence, money and support from the U.S. necessary to do that. Fulbright was really going after that entity because it was raising money from around the world, and by the, obviously in the 1940s, 50s, and of course early 60s, channeling it into the United States to multiply aid arms and influence in what was obviously in the post-war period the dominant superpower in the world. So that's what Fulbright was trying to do. He was attempting to show how this was working, the international and national components and corporate entities of the lobby.
And we have the lobby's representatives squirming and weaseling and dodging and trying hard to do an end run around the Foreign Agents Registration Act.
Right. Well, what you see is essentially, if you look at the Senate record and then later documents, is perjury after perjury. The leadership of the American section of the Jewish agency, which was directly responsible for channeling millions of dollars into domestic lobbying, was essentially stating two extraordinary claims. Number one, that they weren't in any way related to the Israeli government, which was, of course, not true, since several members, including Levi Eshkol, were actually on their executive board. So that was a stretch. And number two, that they actually didn't know what was going on with the money after it was channeled back into the United States. And yet, payment vouchers showing that they were directing funds to Isaiah Kennan, who is the founder of AIPAC, and all sorts of media personalities, whether it's at the New York Times or others, emerged into the Senate record. By 1971, the covenant document of this shadow government, or government in waiting, emerged, showing that as far back as 1953, they had an agreement with the government which allowed them to review any legislation before it went to the Knesset and be able to tap tax dollars for colonization. So essentially, they were hard-pressed to cover this up to Fulbright, who was formerly a DOJ antitrust lawyer and just dogged investigator. But what the record shows is that essentially the subsequent and warranted Department of Justice and FBI investigation was short-circuited and never even really came to light because everything was classified.
One thing that stands out, to me at least from those hearings, was the dizzyingly convoluted architecture of AIPAC.
Right.
It appears to have been designed to confound the most determined of investigators with its vast network of corporations, foundations, political action committees, and other entities through which it clearly laundered money.
Right.
Specifically to steer American policy toward Israeli interests.
Well, and you also see the nucleus of the world we live in today, in which think tanks and subsidized, I would call them embedded media personalities, get to have the final say on regional issues and are always positioned as the opinion and thought leaders for any issue having to do with the region. You see the nucleus of a lot of these organizations and the media strategy, particularly one amazing document which came to light, which was the 1962-1963 media strategy document, which outlines how the lobby was going to approach religious groups, how it was going to cultivate Madison Avenue PR firms. Everything that you would expect in a comprehensive media plan was in this confidential document. And we've put a lot of these online at the What's Real Lobby archive at irmep.org for people to look at. It's a model of strategy, but the preoccupying thing, as you've alluded to, is that all of this was completely illegal under the 1938 Foreign Agents Registration Act, which requires that if you're receiving that kind of directed funding and lobbying in the United States for a foreign entity, you've got to disclose all of it. You can't hide it through various conduits or launder money into hidden initiatives to get around that. But as we've shown in the book, America's Defense Line, that is precisely what was going on.
It is a almost a commonplace to note that many of the extremist Jewish organizations form corporations with nondescript names.
Right.
Something like Americans for Apple Pie, for example.
Materials for Palestine was one of the early ones. What were those materials? Well, they were arms. And were they for Palestine? No, they were for Israel.
And they hide through a labyrinthine networks of corporations. The Jewish Fund, for example, giving money to Corporation A, which gives it to B and C,
right,
and D and so on. And then Corporation, finally, Z, uses it in some form, and the Jewish agency denies knowing anything about it.
Right. And the international component of that makes it all the more impenetrable.
Yeah, this led a very frustrated Senator Fulbright, as you wrote in your book, when he said, to Maurice Buchstein, who was legal counsel for the Jewish agency. He told him, quote, "Your very able and acute legal mind has created some situations here that are very difficult for me to understand, and I have tried." So the crucial issue here is whether or not the Jewish agency was an Israeli government agency. To my knowledge, the Jewish agency in British Mandate Palestine was responsible for immigration, land acquisition, colonization, and the running of schools and hospitals. But on May 14, 1948, when Israel declared itself a state under Ben-Gurion, it became the provisional government of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Later, after 1948, Israel created a new Jewish agency with, predictably, another confusing structure, whose professed mission was primarily education, to promote a favorable image of Israel among the Jewish diaspora. But during the Fulbright hearings in 1963, the Jewish agency executive in Jerusalem counted among its members some very high officials in the Israeli government, such as Zalman Shazar, who became Israel's third president, and then Israeli finance minister Levi Eshkol, who was then finance minister. Now, it's very hard to believe that the monies at the Jewish agency's disposal, which it funneled to the American branch, were not appropriated without the approval of Israeli government officials.
Yes, it is.
I was disappointed to find that Senator Fulbright did not directly challenge the Jewish agency on its governmental status.
Well, he did. He asked them for all relevant documents related to the entities overseas, and they've essentially said, we can't give that to you. He asked for the meeting minutes because Maurice Buchstein claimed that they operated by consensus as opposed to any sort of covenant. Well, that was not true. And later, in a registration filing, a couple of activists forced them to file their covenant agreement. The other thing that you mentioned, which is very interesting, is the testimony of Maurice Buchstein, who is the architect of all of these shell corporations. He stated quite plainly at the end of the hearings to Senator Fulbright that he thought the Foreign Agents Registration Act had to be changed because he stated it needs, quote, considerable modification and change, unquote, presumably because as
the loopholes
enacted, it didn't serve his purposes. And you know, as someone at the head of this massive international lobby, he felt, clearly felt, that his organization and operations needed to be accommodated. The law needed to be accommodated to the operations as opposed to the other way around. That was the main point there. But I think the fact that you mentioned of these transformations, which, again, they chose not to operate under U.S. laws, such as the Foreign Agents Registration Act. But you've mentioned often before, I've listened to some of your podcasts, that for a country with no constitution, no declared boundaries, massive influence, and yet no formal treaty with the United States, getting this kind of flexibility and always being able to, as it happened in 1965, reorganize and launch a new series of shell corporations has really been the history of these entities.
In fact, they claimed, and with a very, very lame answer, that when Salman Shazar was elected president, he had to resign from the board. But the board of governors of the Jewish agency was half of the board was assigned by the Israeli government, and the other half was elected by the community at large. You have very generously called it a quasi-governmental agency. Was it really?
Well, I think the case is strong, and those aren't my words. Those are words of other researchers. You know, clearly the influence of this entity in the United States, in Israel, was strong, and in terms of its activities toward colonization, gathering resources, generating political support where needed, public relations, it was in every sense very similar to where the founder of AIPAC worked originally, which was for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs when Israel was established. So although the labels changed and board members may have entered and left, the fact that it was operating on behalf of the government was always clear. And that's why when the U.S. Justice Department moved to register some of the downstream entities lobbying and doing public relations in the United States, they had documentary evidence and no doubts that all of this ultimately led back to the Israeli government.
You also mention the Rabinowitz Foundation.
Right.
And how the son had admitted that the Jewish agency was, in fact, a government agency, and he was quickly asked to recant that by Bookstein.
Right. Well, this all gets back to the public relations need to always define and then enforce rigid discipline, doctrinal discipline, about what all these organizations are and do. The Rabinowitz Foundation was responsible for operating as a conduit to establish one of the first think tanks formed by Benjamin Schwadron. And this is a precursor to, you know, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, or the takeover of AEI, the launch of the Brookings Saban Center, essentially a think tank which would have a very skillful PR framework of promoting peace in the Middle East, yet which by all of its operations would essentially be, again, another extension of the lobby's efforts to launch public relations. But the letter, which came from the Rabinowitz Foundation, essentially stated, well, we know that after doing a little research that this money that we're receiving and then funneling to the think tank was essentially Israeli government money. And later he was forced to recant that when Maurice Bookstein obviously called him up and put his foot down and said, no, we're really not what we obviously appear to you to be, and got some enforcement there. And that's what makes the Senate record so fascinating. We've put all of that online at the Israel Lobby Archive for people to read. Some of it's not very fun to read because the documents that we scanned from are obviously so old. But the complicated set of wire diagrams which Maurice Bookstein attempted to define this archipelago of corporate entities and money flow didn't really fool Senator Fulbright, and nor will they fool anybody who examines them. There's basically a straight line of influence peddling and efforts to generate grassroots support directly from, you know, Tel Aviv to Washington.
I have to say, Grant, that I find your AIPAC book Absolutely fascinating reading.
Well, I hope you received America's Defense Line.
Yes, I did. Thank you very much.
What we've managed to do in terms of getting the Justice Department, the classified Justice Department case files, and putting them online for anyone to look at, is really reveal how AIPAC was formed in the United States. And I think when people look at how hard Justice Department officials, such as Irene Bowman, Nathan Lenvin, Walter Yeagley, and at the beginning, Nicholas Katzenbach, under the tutelage of Robert F. Kennedy, attempted to put America's interests first and actually regulate this OPAC entity, and how they were so utterly destroyed by 1965 for even daring to do that. It's fascinating to look at the primary documents and be able to see for the very first time in black and white, the machinations and laws that had to be subverted to put all of this together. And yet, of course, although it's all out there now, the mainstream media has been reticent, to say the least, at exploring this, even in light of probably the most interesting two developments in recent history. Number one being the indictment of two AIPAC lobbyists under the Espionage Act for doing what this organization routinely does. And number two, the entrance of an Obama administration that is very, very similar to the Kennedy administration in terms of the promises it's made and the new appointments that it's now making are so similar, and yet we're not getting any of this analysis out there in the mainstream.
Yeah, let me mention for the benefit of our listeners, the two books that are specifically on AIPAC, Foreign Agents in America's Defense Line, can be obtained from the Institute for Research, Middle East, and Policy.
I'd like to mention MiddleEastBooks.com, which is the Washington Report for Middle East Affairs bookselling entity.
I see.
They actually offer the paperback version with free shipping, so I'd like to mention that as well.
Sure, Middle East. You've mentioned Obama, and the burning question is, what do you know about President-elect Obama's choice of Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel and his relationship, if any, to AIPAC or any of its affiliates?
Well, I think in this case, the mainstream press hasn't failed. They've mentioned the fact that Rahm Emanuel is a principal node in the Israel lobby campaign contribution network, that he wasn't necessarily really behind Obama until he switched sides in June, away from Hillary Clinton, probably because it looked like she wasn't going to be viable, and then introduced Obama to the power elite of AIPAC at their annual conference. And ever since then, and this is why I say it's a remarkable mirror of the Kennedy administration, of course, he's been named Chief of Staff. We know all about his father's illustrious past, as the press calls it gun running. I would call it something different, with the Irgun and his own participation in Israel's war efforts back in the 91 Gulf War, et cetera, et cetera. But what people don't understand is the following. Obama's made some pretty implicit promises about winding down the confrontational approach to the Middle East, as well as getting troops out of Iran. But yet, he's appointed Rahm Emanuel as his chief of staff. Kennedy entered government with a similar approach, in which he had to accommodate the lobby's principal donors in a meeting with Abraham Feinberg, in which he pretty much was told that he had to accommodate his Middle East policy to the power players of the law. Because of that, he appointed Meyer Feldman into his cabinet, very similar to Rahm Emanuel. Feldman had access to all of the State Department cables coming out of the region. It was a node that the various ambassadors did not want, because they were attempting to do many things that they didn't want to be leaked immediately to the Israelis in terms of peace initiatives, etc., etc. And yet, by 1962, 1963, Kennedy, in spite of having put his foot down against the developments of Israeli nuclear weapons at Dimona in a harsh letter to, I call him Levi, you call him Levy, you're correct. Prime Minister Eshkol was being essentially neutered. The lobby was effectively channeling funds overseas to develop Israeli nuclear weapons, and all of this was in spite of Kennedy's non-proliferation activities. By 1963, Kennedy was teaming up with Senator Fulbright, saying that all of this spurious legislation constantly being annexed to bills and the constant propaganda war against the Arab government was not in America's interest. He was backing away from many of his public promises that he made at the beginning of his administration. And so there are a lot of parallels, and I think probably that Obama probably has some understanding that it doesn't matter whether you've won with $100 donations from millions of people who are paying for change. He's essentially negating a lot of that grassroots support by making appointments and concessions to the lobby, which reveal some harsh truths. That it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that there is a grassroots groundswell for a different approach. He's putting in people, and he's accommodating, apparently, policies and positions that have nothing to do with American grassroots interests.
Yeah, it's like Patrick Buchanan said, the best democracy money can buy.
Well, it wasn't, because the money that Obama received, again, was phenomenal. It was an outreach over the internet to millions of people who felt completely disconnected from the U.S. political system, who felt empowered by giving him $10, $20, and $30 donations. The groundswell that he was able to harvest over the internet is what probably
definitely it won him the election. But
it won him the election
compared to the monies oppose it.
Well, I haven't done an analysis of the donations yet.
No, the donations to come. And perhaps this is a good point to turn to another very troubling area of AIPAC activity, which is election law violations and the intimidation or demise of members of Congress who do not unconditionally support Israel.
Right.
Now, there is a rich history to that. Senator Charles Percy, for example, and Representative Paul Findley, both of Illinois, were defeated. So was Governor Scranton of Pennsylvania, Senator Adlai Stevenson, Representative Pete McCloskey, and so on. And more recently, Cynthia McKinney. You wrote in your book, and here I have the... Let me read that in Foreign Agents, you recount an incident in 1985, for example, when Michael Goland, a former director of AIPAC, went to Congress to oppose President Reagan's proposal to sell arms to Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
He went to the Senate cloakroom, was introduced as of Percy Factor fame, an obvious reference to Senator Percy's defeat. And this move was considered by some senators and lobbyists as a crude form of intimidation. And as you wrote in your book, Senator Alan Simpson, a Republican of Wyoming, later brought the incident up on the Senate floor, saying he was bothered by the notion that the legislator cannot waver in support of Israel, and warning, quote, "You cannot build friendship on threats or intimidation or talk of political retribution or the ancient political game of keeping score." So we have here a monster that is intimidating every member of Congress who does not toe the line. A lot of people are chafing, but looking ahead to their re-election, they have no choice but to cower to that interest.
Well, here's the problem, and this is why we call the book America's Defense Line. America's Defense Line is rule of law and actually implementing and enforcing the law equally. What we find in the case of AIPAC is a history in which it's been found to have engaged in election fraud or violated its charter as a nonprofit organization, and yet as soon as the rare charges enter into any sort of enforcement proceeding, they've been subverted. The Michael Goland case is interesting because he actually spent some 3 months in prison for his role in fixing the California Senate race. But let's just look at what I think is probably the crown jewel of evidence of AIPAC election law violation, which is a September 30, 1986 internal memo, which was published in the Washington Post of all places, in which, in violation of its 501c3 nonprofit status, which says that it cannot get involved in supporting individual political candidates, AIPAC was found to be doing exactly that. It sent out detailed instructions to political action committees, again, the nondescript entities set up across the United States, particularly in places like the Dakotas, where there is no grassroots support, to direct money to candidates such as Tom Daschle, etc., etc. This was published showing that not only had it been directing political action committee donations in particular races to boost its own influence, but that it had been involved in establishing many of these political action committees. Also another violation of its status. Well, this particular case enraged a lot of people, particularly people in the State Department and other agencies of government who had felt this pressure but never seen so clearly how it was implemented through illegal activity. And they complained to the FEC, the Federal Elections Commission, which wouldn't do anything. And so they started processes which eventually even went to the Supreme Court, which would not address the merits of the case. And that, by the way, is something that is repeated throughout history in any sort of legal action involving the Middle East, and kicked it back down to where it languished and was never really resolved. We put that memo up on the Internet, by the way, in the Israel Lobby Archive. It's fascinating to look at it. Whenever you hear a claim that AIPAC is not a political action committee and that it does not engage in any sort of support for candidates in races, because this document simply shows that that's not true.
That doesn't pass the laugh test. But we are rapidly running out of time, Grant, and so I'd like to just touch on a couple of subjects very quickly. One which cries for attention is a proposal which you uncovered that was circulated in Congress during Truman's time, asking for a support of a Jewish army in Palestine,
right,
manifestly to fight Nazis and so-called fifth columnists. What was not mentioned in there was that this Jewish army, also known as the National Military Organization, was really a front for the Irgun, Menachem Begin's terrorist group. And you wrote that in January 1941, the Irgun proposed an alliance plan to Nazi leaders, in which the NMO would fight alongside Germany. And even after the United States entered the war on December 8, 1941, one day after Pearl Harbor, Congressman Somers of New York was lobbying Truman for the formation of the very same army, which planned to fight on the side of the Germans. That's quite stunning, don't you think?
Well, and finally, these are the documents that never make it into the mainstream narrative because they don't support the mainstream narrative.
Right.
And yet these documents have been around and circulating since the early 70s, which really, I think the whole Irgun take is really interesting because this is an entity which has penetrated Congress. It's penetrated the Treasury Department back when the Treasury Department was supporting Vladimir Jabotinsky and all sorts of efforts that the Irgun men in the United States were supporting. And now, by virtue of a recent appointment of Rahm Emanuel, although he's not a member, his father was, and has been active in commenting about Rahm's role in the cabinet, it's fascinating to see how this organization, again, a terrorist organization by all accounts, is active in U.S. politics. And well, yet, of course, the narrative is that the Palestinians are the terrorists, which is utterly ridiculous.
The United States Congress is Israeli-occupied territory.
Well, that's Pat Buchanan's and
right,
Paul
exactly.
Finley's and others.
Yes. Well, we say it as a yuck, but it's true. And we really have just 1 minute, Grant.
Okay.
If you could take us to the situation today and the spy trial involving AIPAC operatives Steve Rosen and Keith Weissman.
All right.
The trial has been languishing for 3 years.
Yes, it has.
What is happening?
Well, it's recently become active. In the Fourth Circuit of Appeals, the government has recently had to appeal ruling Judge T.S. Ellis's affirmation that the two are alleged spies, that the government has to prove that they intended to harm the United States, which is not in the Espionage Act. So he's raised the barrier, and the government's appealed it. He's also stated that they have to show all sorts of classified information that the government wants to keep secret, basically, that they'd like to only review in closed sessions. So we filed an amicus brief in that, saying that there's been too much history of cover-ups and subversion of justice. We need to see this go to trial soon. But again, right now it's in the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, and nobody knows whether the government's, whether the appeals panel is going to make the government prove things that it probably can't.
I'm afraid we have to end it there, Grant. Thank you so much for being our guest today.
Okay, thank you so much for having me.
It was a pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks, Sharif.
And that is all we have for today. We wish our listeners a pleasant and restful weekend and look forward to having you with us next week, same time. Until then, this is Sharif Fahm signing off for this week in Palestine and urging our listeners to get involved. من مخيم